y avait un jardin qu'on appelait la terre. Il brillait au soleil comme un fruit défendu. Non, ce n'était pas le paradis ni l'enfer, ni rien de déjà vu ou déjà entendu. La la la, la la la, la la la. Il y avait un jardin, une maison, des arbres, avec un lit de mousse pour y faire l'amour, et un petit ruisseau roulant sans une vague venait le rafraîchir et poursuivait son cours. La la la, la la la, la la la. Il y avait un jardin grand comme une vallée. On pouvait s'y nourrir à toutes les saisons. Sur la terre brûlante ou sur l'herbe gelée. Des fleurs qui n'avaient pas de nom. La la la, la la la, la la la. Il y avait un jardin qu'on appelait la terre. Il était assez grand pour des milliers d'enfants. Il était habité jadis par nos grands-pères qui le tenaient eux-mêmes de leurs grands-parents. La la la, la la la, la la la. Où est-il ce jardin où nous aurions pu naître? Nous aurions pu vivre insouciants et nus. Où est cette maison, toutes portes ouvertes, que je cherche encore et que je ne trouve plus. La la la, la la la, la la la.
At that time, Matthew Chen was working in my lab, and he knew that rivers are really important for transporting nutrients across the landscape, and so he wondered, what did this flood do? He went into this question thinking, well, we know phosphorus likes to stick on to particles, so phosphorus concentrations will probably track discharge, become elevated when we have the flood, and then return to normal. Nitrogen, we really weren't sure what was going to happen. We suspected dilution because nitrate's in our groundwater. So if you get more surface water, that should dilute out the nitrogen coming from the groundwater. But we weren't sure. But as I mentioned, we didn't start working in the river until 2019. So we didn't have any pre-flood data. But fortunately, a bunch of the National Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Park Service had been collecting water quality data from the river beforehand, so he was able to harvest that data, add it to our own collections, and then write up a really nice paper looking at how the loads and concentrations of nitrogen and phosphorus responded to that flooding event. And so between before and after the flood, you can see a really strong decrease in nitrate and a strong increase in phosphorus, which kind of made sense. What made a little less sense was the fact that nitrate levels persisted to be low after the flood. There's no reason to think that they shouldn't have rebounded, much like the phosphorus did. We collected data again the following year, and it really took until those 2021 samplings until the nitrate levels return back to normal. I don't know why this happened this way. We tried to look into some of the groundwater data to see if there are changes there. I haven't really found a good data source yet for that. So if you know of any, please come talk to me. But this would be a really good thing to figure out, right? Like, why all of a sudden do these nitrate concentrations decrease? And why did they stay low for so long? Is it somehow that the flood ramped up denitrification? Or did a bunch of nitrogen get flushed out of the system? Was there some change in watershed use? I don't know. So it would be really good to figure out, because that could help us manage nitrate concentrations moving forward. So the other thing that came out of this, right, is this legacy of extreme floods. It wasn't just that first year after the flood that we saw the effect on the ecosystem, but it was still 2 years after until the ecosystem really rebounded from that flood condition. So when we're studying these extreme events, long-term data are important. All right, so from the Niobrara, let's go to the Elkhorn, and actually we won't do much there, but I just wanted to give a shout out to some new work that I have funded with Paul Ayayi and David Manning at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, where we're diving into these questions about the river ecology in Nebraska, or in the Niobrara and the Elkhorn River. I'm not talking about the data today, but I do have longer term data on periphyton abundance in the Niobrara, nutrient limitation of that periphyton, and we're doing the same collections in the Elkhorn. Paul is also looking at the microbial communities in those systems, and David is also doing some other ecosystem metrics, looking at metabolism and primary production and respiration in those systems too. Okay, now let's move to lakes, and that is the Sand Hills region out in western Nebraska. And the question here is that if a lake has a lot of nutrients, does it matter if it gets more, right? If we've already saturated our aquatic ecosystems with nitrogen and phosphorus, does it really matter if we add any more, right? Are we gonna see a difference in growth in those ecosystems? And this is an important question for Nebraska, because if we look across our state, you know, about 60% of our lakes could be considered eutrophic. They're already saturated with nitrogen and phosphorus. So if we think about those blooms and cyanobacterial production, you know, do they respond to more nutrients or not? And this is some work that my PhD student, Daniel Geschwenter, is working on. He's doing a lot more cool stuff. I am just picking out a little bit of it for this talk. But he took advantage of the fact that the lakes in the Sand Hills region, you do see a span of concentration of nutrients in those systems. Some of them have really high values, some of them have lower values, as well as some of them are more along the freshwater continuum, and some of them have a lot more salinity in them. These gradients are largely related to how connected the lakes are to the groundwater in the area. So if they're less connected, they tend to be more evaporitic and concentrate stuff in them. Versus they can get, if they're more connected to the groundwater, they tend to be fresher. It's a simplification of it, but that's where we are. What I think is really kind of amazing in these lakes is that you have Border Lake, which has over a milligram per liter of phosphorus in it, which is just, I mean, it's incredible. So before I came to Nebraska, I was working in lakes up in Wisconsin, where there's another, I mean, the whole state is basically a lake district. So you had another lake district kind of like this, a bunch of lakes together in the landscape, and the lakes up there, like if they were over 0.1 milligrams or 100 micrograms per liter of phosphorus, people would freak out. Usually it was like 0.01. So magnitudes of order less phosphorus in those lakes up in the forested landscapes of Wisconsin versus down here. Yeah, just really incredibly high numbers. So these are the systems that you think would not respond to nutrients, right? They've got all that they need. Well, it turns out it could be could be a different story. This is a, before I jump into the results, here's a close-up of those lakes. So if you just take a plastic jar, put some water in it, that's what they look like. And you can see there is quite a bit of growth in Bean and Border lakes. All right, so Daniel went out there repeatedly in May, June, July, August, took jars of water, diluted them so things had some room to grow, added either nitrogen, phosphorus, nitrogen and phosphorus together, or neither, and looked at the growth response. Also added trace elements, which is TE. So those are the micronutrients that might be important cofactors in different enzyme activities. So sort of a like really squinting your eyes, what's going on here in our most nutrient-rich lake, they're still responding to inputs of nitrogen and phosphorus together, right? We can still get a little bit more growth. In the other high or medium nutrient lake, we see some indication of nitrogen-phosphorus co-limitation, nitrogen limitation in Island Lake, and then phosphorus limitation in Smith. Again, I am super squinting my eyes to making these assessments. Daniel's got way more information about the nuance of the different responses. But this is all to say that even though these lakes are really eutrophic, they could grow even more things in them. So when we think about managing lakes in Nebraska, yes, things will respond to more nutrients. They can get greener. And you also need to think about nitrogen and phosphorus, not just one. Some of you in this room may have been trained up under the phosphorus paradigm, that phosphorus is the only limiting nutrient to lakes. Let me tell you that that is not true. It can be, but it can also be nitrogen. The flip side is, you might think that, you know, we live in Nebraska, we have to think about nitrates, and you're therefore ignoring phosphorus, and I am here to tell you, you can't ignore phosphorus. You have to think of phosphorus too. So I wanted to dive in a little bit more with nitrogen and phosphorus and go through just a little bit of a thought exercise. Microcystins, or a microcystin is a type of cyanotoxin created by that organism, Microcystis, there on the slide, form of cyanobacteria. And this work from Ortehel et al., surveying a bunch of lakes in Canada, found that you tend to get the most cyanotoxins at low nitrogen to phosphorus ratios. So low nitrogen to phosphorus ratios means a lot of extra phosphorus compared to nitrogen in that ecosystem. That tends to be watershed-wise related to areas where you have CAFOs or lots of animal production. So taking that number, here's another look at total nitrogen versus total phosphorus in the system, and where you get those colors of the dots indicating more cyanotoxins, it tends to be when you're below this threshold of about 23. So to the extent that we can extrapolate things from Canada to the US, to our lake systems, I was curious to say, okay, we've got a lot of data on nutrient levels in our lakes. How many of those lakes fall below that entropy ratio? And it turns out, you know, not an insignificant amount, right? So this is from a survey from the EPA from 2017. And it certainly suggests that a number of our lakes could fall below that threshold, meaning that they might be lakes more susceptible to those cyanotoxins. We also have good data on cyanotoxins, and so sort of the next step of this project is to start looking at those connections a bit more. But I just want to say it again. Are we doing enough in Nebraska to manage phosphorus? The answer is no. Okay, moving now a little bit more locally. Here we are in Lincoln, and I don't quite have all the time to go through the other projects that are currently happening in the lab, but I wanted to bring some up. So I have another PhD student in the lab, Uche, who's really interested in the reservoirs around Lancaster County. He's looking at inputs into the reservoirs and outputs of those nutrients, trying to figure out how water level in the reservoirs relates to nutrient retention capacity. It's going to be a pretty exciting project, but it's just started up, so I don't have a lot of data there. And Jace Miller is a brand new PhD student in my lab, also interested in phosphorus dynamics and the role of viruses in moving phosphorus in our aquatic ecosystems.
Thanks. up to greet me. Those raindrops keep falling on my head, but that doesn't mean my eyes will soon be turning red. Crying's not for me, no. I'm never gonna stop the rain by complaining, because I'm free.
Radio Lora, Radio Lora, Radio
Lora, 97,5.
Weltempfänger ausgemacht.
Radio Lora, 97,5. Radio Lora, dies
Alternativradio auf 97,5.
Weltempfänger ausgemacht.
Es ist ein gutes und ein wahres und ein schönes, allumfassendes Gefühl. Es lässt sich nicht vorhersehen, lässt sich nicht erzwingen und es passt in kein Kalkül. Es mag für einen Augenblick sein und für immer, es ist frei vom Zwang der Zeit. Es ist das Teil, es ist das ganze Universum, es ist jede Winzigkeit. Es ist die immer neue pathetische Filmszene in ewiger Wiederkehr. Liebe ist alles. Liebe ist mehr. Liebe ist alles. Liebe ist mehr. Es ist das Lächeln eines Fremden auf dem Flur, wo du die Wartemarke löst. Es ist der kleine schwarze Straßenhund, der friedlich in der Mittagssonne döst. Es ist der Freund, der sich für dich um Mitternacht nochmal in seine Küche stellt und dir was brutzelt und dem deine traurige Geschichte gar nicht auf den Wecker fällt. Und für ein Sixpack von der Nachttankstelle stürzt er sich für dich in den Verkehr. Liebe ist alles. Liebe ist mehr. Liebe ist alles. Liebe ist mehr. Es ist der blanke, liebte Bär, aus dem dich die Holzwolle piekt. Dein altes Ruderboot, das wartend an verborgener Stelle liegt. Es ist das alte Haus, das knarrt und leise wispert. Weißt du noch, wie es auf dem Dachboden nach Äpfeln und nach Abenteuern war? Die Truhe, die verschlossene Tür, die ausgetretene Stufe raunt. Komm her, komm her. Liebe ist alles. Liebe ist mehr. Liebe ist alles. Liebe ist mehr. Jemand, der auf dem Bahnsteig wartet, im Gedrängen, ein Aufflackern, ein Gesicht. Die Ahnung und das Hoffen, nur ein flüchtiger Blick und Takt im fahlen Neonlicht. Es ist die Sehnsucht und das Streicheln, die Umarmung, aber auch die Wehmut schon. Und das für immer hingehaucht zur Zimmerdecke einer schäbigen Pension. Es ist das Bittere und das Süße und es lässt dich federleicht und Tränen schwer. Liebe ist alles. Liebe ist mehr. Es ist die immer neue pathetische Filmszene in ewiger Wiederkehr. Liebe ist alles, Liebe ist mehr. Liebe ist alles, Liebe ist mehr.
Radio Lora auf der Frequenz 97,5 MHz.
El agua es la sustancia que más abunda en la Tierra y es la única que se encuentra en la atmósfera en estado líquido, sólido y gaseoso. La mayor reserva de agua está en los océanos, que contiene el 97% del agua que existe en la Tierra. Se trata de agua salada, que solo permite la vida de la flora y fauna marina. El resto es agua dulce, pero no toda está disponible. Gran parte permanece siempre helada, formando los casquetes polares y los glaciales. El agua dulce es impredecible para la vida, pero la cantidad disponible es escasa y su distribución desigual. Además, varía a lo largo del año y está sujeta a cambios provocados por la actividad humana. Los usos más importantes están relacionados con la agricultura y el consumo industrial y doméstico. Su demanda se ha incrementado notablemente con el crecimiento de la población en las últimas décadas. Se han multiplicado las áreas agrícolas dependientes del riego para la producción de alimentos. Las industrias y actividades mineras la emplean para el lavado, enfriamiento, dilución, remojo, procesamiento, eliminación de productos de desecho. El agua es tan importante que incluso en ella surgió la vida hace aproximadamente 4,000 millones de años, la cual, gracias a la evolución, derivó una gran diversidad de especies. La molécula del agua está constituida químicamente por dos átomos de hidrógeno unidos a un átomo de oxígeno mediante enlaces covalentes, dando origen así a una estructura química de masa molecular aproximadamente de 18 unidades. Una propiedad de vital importancia de este líquido es la capilaridad, capacidad de ascender por paredes de un capilar debido a su aumento de la cohesión molecular, o sea, unión entre moléculas, tomando en cuenta su elevada constante dieléctrica, y por ascender por las paredes de un capilar. El agua participa en la termorregulación al tener un alto calor específico y un alto calor de vaporización. También se le considera como un disolvente polar de carácter universal debido a su elevada constante dieléctrica, o sea, dos cargas, y a su bajo grado de ionización, y es el mejor disolvente para todas aquellas moléculas polares. De igual manera, presenta un elevado calor específico, el cual permite que la temperatura de los organismos permanezca constante, aunque varíe la temperatura ambiental.
El agua es indispensable para la vida, porque ningún organismo sobrevive sin ella. Es un constituyente esencial de la materia viva y la fuente de hidrógeno para los organismos. También influye en ellos a través de la atmósfera y el clima. Es el medio en el que se desarrolla la abundante y variada flora y fauna acuática. Los seres vivos están formados en su mayor parte por agua. En el caso de algunos animales marinos, el porcentaje de agua puede superar el 95%. Las semillas secas, que conservan solo rastros de humedad, no pueden germinar sin absorber grandes cantidades de agua. El agua interviene en todas las funciones vitales de plantas y animales.
El agua está presente en la vida de todo ser viviente y en nuestro planeta.